Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3009, United States of America versus Jerome M. Carter, appellant. Ms. Dyer for the appellant, Mr. Bounds for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Jerome Carter, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Carter appeals 6 prior convictions, 4 of which added 6 points to his criminal history score, which was a total of 18. Mr. Carter did not recall those convictions.
Suppose he had only had 3 of them. What would have been the effect then?
Only 3 of the convictions?
3 of the 4.
So that the criminal history score was still in a Category 6?
It would still be the
court's
same
question.
Right?
Then I think that we have the right, or the district court could well have decided to impose a lower sentence within the sentencing guidelines range. Although the court said that it was going to impose the maximum sentence, that was when the criminal history score was 18, which was the highest number, or way over a Category 6 number as listed. As a 13 even, or as a 12, that category, it either would have been a 5, or even if it was a 6, it would have been a lower number within that score, and the district court might well have imposed.
Given what the judge had to say, it doesn't appear it would have made any difference if one of them were a mistake.
Well, the district court wasn't presented with an accurate criminal history score under our argument.
What was inaccurate about it? I mean, I read your brief, I read the transcript, and as far as I can tell, it was entirely accurate. What's the inaccuracy?
There is no other circumstance that I'm aware of in the criminal justice system or in the court system in general in which an adversary is not entitled to
Listen very carefully to my question. What was inaccurate about it?
What was inaccurate about the criminal history? When a litigant challenges the sufficiency of evidence to support a factual finding, that is a challenge to the accuracy of that finding.
What was inaccurate about it? He didn't challenge it. He said, I don't remember what all I've been convicted of. But you have had months and months and months, and I have not seen anything cited that was inaccurate about the history, as far as we can tell from the record.
If the evidence is unreliable and there is not sufficient evidence to reach a preponderance finding that that conviction existed, that citation in the PSR is inaccurate.
It's not inaccurate. You may be saying that the evidence of its accuracy is not strong enough, but if it was not correct, if he didn't have precisely those convictions, why did not either trial counsel, who was a good lawyer too, or you call to the attention of the court what the inaccuracy was? You haven't raised an inaccuracy. To say the evidence is not as strong as you think it should be is not the same thing as saying it's wrong. And you've had plenty of time to show us if it's inaccurate.
Every factual finding in the court system is based on a standard of proof which requires reliable evidence for the fact finder to make that finding.
You're telling me that it is all entirely accurate, right?
No. If we cannot recall it, then we cannot say that it is accurate. We do not believe it is accurate. Based on what we know, we could use all kinds
of
language.
What part of it do you not believe is accurate?
We could say that's
not... Which of those convictions did he not have?
That's not the way he remembered it. He didn't remember
it. He didn't remember how many convictions
Therefore,
he had.
Therefore, it is not accurate. He cannot say that it is accurate.
Counsel, there was evidence of these 4 convictions.
That evidence was unreliable. It was based on hearsay without...
Then why didn't you go and find out if there were any inaccuracies? The judge expressly said, look, I'll recess court. I'll give time if you can come back and show me it's
not... It is not our burden to prove these convictions. It is
right.
The government's
Nobody
burden.
Said it was your burden to prove.
If the
but
evidence...
the government offered evidence.
If the evidence...
You say the evidence is not accurate, and yet you're unable to tell me any way in which it's not accurate.
Suppose, Your Honor, that the PSR writer interviewed the defendant's mother, and the mother said in an interview, probation officer, I have a vague recollection that he had a conviction in 1974 for theft. And the PSR writer used that information to arrive at his conclusion.
The government would have a much, much weaker case on sufficiency of the evidence, and yours would be much, much stronger.
But my point is that we
Here you had dates and places. right?
We had dates and places that he did not recall, but my point...
Yeah, dates and places. Forget whether he recalled or not. Forget about him recalling.
Okay.
You are a good lawyer, and if there was an inaccuracy, you would have found it.
My point, Your Honor, is if we challenge the sufficiency, we have no way, we are completely blind of knowing whether that evidence is based on a smidgen of evidence, of unreliable evidence, or a wealth of reliable evidence.
Isn't this only going to matter in those cases where there isn't a judgment of conviction or the case file is lost? In other words, in this kind of case, you could have gone to the official case files and checked. Under your theory of the case, the government would have to go to the official case file and get a more official record and check. So it's only going to matter who has to go there in 95% of the cases, maybe 99% of the cases. This issue on the burden is only going to matter in those cases, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, where the records are missing, which they sometimes are in state courts.
Judge Kavanaugh, we rarely get the actual conviction records, and I don't think it's too onerous a burden to require the government
but
to
you
get
but you could,
judgment.
Right?
I have had the circumstance occur to me where I've gotten a letter from the clerk of the Superior Court saying that records were missing, and I have put that in a brief.
Right,
and
that happens on occasion,
Finish. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
When the government filed its opposition brief, the government went to the Superior Court, and lo and behold, those records were found. So I don't know for sure that we are as successful at uncovering missing records as the government may be in some circumstances. In that circumstance, we were not. I have also been in the circumstance where once at a time we could obtain NCIC listings. We cannot now. We have no access to the NCIC database. But there was a stolen gun report. Now, my client wouldn't have had any way of knowing whether or not the gun was stolen, so he would not be able to contest the accuracy of the finding under the guidelines that the gun was stolen. When I reviewed the NCIC report, which was repeated in the Superior Court PSR, which the probation office incidentally did use in this case, and then repeated in the defendant's PSR in federal court, that stolen gun listed a serial number, but it was the wrong serial number for the wrong model of gun.
The other problem is that the standard's preponderance. If the standard were beyond a reasonable doubt, which obviously if Almendarez-Torres were overruled, it would be, then you'd have a much stronger case, but on a preponderance with computerized records that are certified by the state court, refer to the defendant's name, the record, I don't see how that can't be a preponderance.
Don't say who the declarant is. It becomes like a game of telephone. It's repeated three times. The errors are repeated and compounded.
What errors?
The error in the stolen gun.
Why did you not bring us an error if you claim they're erroneous?
Your Honor, we don't have access. In my example, we don't have access to the NCIC. I cannot look at that initial report.
These are, if they're accurate, they're consistent with court records. Do you have anything to show us from the courts where these convictions were supposed to have been?
We don't have any records, and we did not go get records.
Right.
However, these records.
You could have checked, right?
I don't know. I don't know whether we would have been able to.
No, you could have
checked.
It may not be there.
We
could have checked.
The Maryland courts.
Then you could have told us they were.
But if there were a judgment and that judgment were certified, we obviously would have no problem with these records. These records are, it's like a double whammy for the defendant. The defendant has no right to a jury trial on proof of these facts. And then we have no right to even see the evidence and see whether it's a tiny little bit of unreliable evidence.
Who prevented you from seeing the court records in Maryland? I mean, I practiced criminal law for a lot of years, and I didn't have any trouble finding out my client's records in days before we had the kind of computerized databases there are today, but why could you not go to the courthouses in Maryland or have an investigator go there and find out?
Your Honor, this is one example, but there are many examples under the sentencing guidelines.
This is the only one we're interested in right now.
All right. Well, it is not our responsibility to go get the criminal history records. It's not our responsibility to show the defendant's criminal
history.
But
it's a preponderance standard. And once there is evidence of the government's position, why is it not your responsibility?
Why isn't it our right to challenge that evidence? There is no other...
You had every right to challenge. You were given every opportunity to challenge it, but you did not do so successfully.
We did challenge it. We said it is unreliable. We don't have this evidence that the government did present in this case and that the district court found to be reliable and relied on, stated that it was relying on, was not reliable evidence. It doesn't even state the declarant. We don't know who... entered this evidence into
How is this any different than in any normal dispute where one side puts on evidence that the other side thinks is insufficient, and you're saying in response, your sole response to this was that that your client couldn't recall if what the government fought for it was accurate. That happens all the time in cases, and you have to balance which is more sufficient. And here you lost because your client couldn't recall. That's just not a very strong answer.
The difference, Judge Griffith, in my view, is that in the adversary system, we have the right to put on evidence, but we don't have the responsibility. If the evidence that the party that bears the burden of proof puts on, there's the preponderance standard, let's say, is here. And the reasonable doubt standard is up here. And the clear and convincing standard is somewhere, we don't know where, in the middle. And there has to be evidence reaching this level that is sufficiently reliable and enough evidence to find more that it's more probable than
not. Isn't Price the guideline for us here? And Price says you have to come forward with factual assertions about identifying what's wrong with the PSR.
Well, I recognize that this panel cannot reverse Price, and I want to just be good. Perfectly clear to state that I do disagree with the conclusion in Price and in Pinnock. But I think that this court can distinguish those cases by the types of facts that defendants are likely to recall accurately and the types of facts that a defendant is not. And criminal history, defendants may well remember conduct that they committed. Although in this case, with 37 prior convictions, I don't know that the defendant would have remembered even the conduct. But defendants don't actually remember the legal disposition or the consequences of that conduct. There are often cases with multiple charges, some of which are dismissed, some of which are null pros, charges in neighboring jurisdictions are dropped.
I thought your argument was that Price and Pinnock were inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Mitchell.
I think they are, and I believe that Price and Pinnock are wrongly decided, but I'm offering this panel another way to distinguish those cases. The types of cases like whether I mentioned reasonably foreseeable conduct of co-conspirators, but there's also...
Can I just say one other thing? Haven't most courts said the computerized records of this nature are sufficient to satisfy the preponderance?
No, I think there's a circuit split, and I think certainly the Sixth and the Second Circuit appear not to believe...
Wasn't there about five that went the other way, though?
Well, the Ninth and the Tenth appear to. I think that within many circuits, from my review, which I have not done a complete circuit review, I have to say. There are inconsistent
decisions. What circuits did you identify? The Second and the Sixth? Those weren't on these kinds of computerized certified records.
Well, the Second Circuit case that we submitted a 28J letter record was. And that may be the only one on these types of computerized records as opposed to the question of sufficiency versus
certified.
Challenging the accuracy. And the Ninth and the Tenth, I think, do accept those records. But I think they're inconsistent decisions within some circuits as well.
First Circuit.
Unless my
yes.
colleagues have further questions, you
Thank
are
Thank you very
time.
Much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Bounds.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Judge. May it please the Court, I'm joined at counsel's table by Assistant United States Attorneys Angela Schmidt, who was the trial counsel in this case, and Elizabeth Crosman, Deputy Chief of the Appellate Division. As this court has recognized in its questions, and in fact, it seems that appellant's counsel has conceded to some degree, Price does control the disposition of this case.
Does that make sense to say that the defendant doesn't have a right to silence at sentencing when the Supreme Court clearly said in the Mitchell case that the defendant does have a right to silence at sentencing? And
there's no dispute that the appellant, that a defendant in a criminal case retains his right under the Fifth Amendment to remain silent at sentencing. That is not the issue here. The issue here
well,
is
the issue. Well, if the defendant remains silent at sentencing in this case, then you are prohibited from raising a sufficiency challenge to the prior convictions.
The right to remain silent is a testimonial.
That seems a serious penalty on the right to remain silent at sentencing that the Supreme Court recognized in Mitchell.
Well, first, the right to remain silent is a testimonial privilege, so it certainly has no bearing on the appellant or the defendant's right through counsel to challenge.
In other words, his counsel could have offered evidence other than his testimonial evidence. He could have
certainly
offered certified records that were contrary to
that. That is not only certainly true, but also what we're talking about here is merely a challenge to sufficiency, which is not even a testimonial issue. It's
so
not
even
an evidentiary.
At the guilt innocence phase, if the government's evidence is sufficient and the defendant offers no evidence, then that is weighed in the balance. Not that he didn't testify, but that the evidence is uncontested by any means.
And that is precisely the reason that Mitchell is inapplicable as cited by the Ninth Circuit in footnote 4 of the case.
I don't read the Ninth Circuit footnote that way. I don't think it said that.
What the Ninth Circuit held was
all the Ninth Circuit said is if you remain silent, then the judge weighs the evidence based on or makes the decision based on all the evidence in the record. Obvious. It didn't say that if you remain silent at sentencing, you can't raise a sufficiency challenge. It didn't say that.
My understanding was that Chief Judge Sentell was saying that the court would weigh the evidence before it. And
sure, you weigh the evidence and determine whether it's sufficient. But my understanding of what you're saying is if the defendant doesn't say, that's wrong, you can't just say, that's insufficient. And normally in criminal cases, you're allowed to sit there and say nothing, and defense counsel can say that's insufficient evidence. You don't have to contest anything.
And they certainly, the defendant here, the appellant, had the prerogative to do exactly that, but that is not sufficient to overcome the presumptive reliability of the pre-sentence report, which is squarely the
holding. That's a different argument, I think.
I'm not sure that I would agree with that characterization because it's all about what the baseline evidentiary value of the pre-sentence report is. And this court has repeatedly held, and Rule 32(i)(3) specifically allows, that the pre-sentence report is presumptively reliable authority for all the facts alleged therein. And so if you have presumptively reliable authority for a fact, whether it's a prior conviction or anything else, and you have nothing else before you, then the only issue is whether that preponderance of evidence standard has been met.
So and this court would in Price. Have been sufficient here even if we didn't have the computerized records, if the PSR just referred to the prior convictions?
Certainly, without doubt, that is the holding in Price.
Do you have to defend that proposition?
I don't think that's the holding of Price.
We certainly don't have to insofar as we win whether the court wants to look at the certified records of the Maryland district courts or not. But Price holds that you have to dispute the factual accuracy of an alleged conviction in order to bring it into dispute for purposes of Rule 32 or in the alternative this court's holding.
And that's inconsistent with the usual rule in criminal cases. Mm-hmm.
It is not insufficient for purposes of sentencing. I mean, it's not intention with Mitchell. It's not intention with Mitchell.
Can't you lose that part of the argument and still win the case? I mean, it doesn't have to be your position that he can't challenge it. It's just that he can't successfully challenge it. Aren't you saying the evidence here is sufficient?
So I'm certainly saying that.
Then why do you care whether he can challenge the sufficiency or not? Can't you say even if he can challenge it, he can't do so successfully?
I agree with Your Honor, and I'm
your easier hill to climb seems to me that these computerized certified records are sufficient evidence to show the prior convictions.
It's an uphill climb, you say?
That's an easier hill.
Sorry. Yes.
All climbs are uphill.
Very good point. Well, for the reasons that we have discussed here and that the court has so helpfully identified, including the presumptive validity of the district court records from Maryland and the other reasons identified in our brief and our 28J letter, the government would respectfully
suppose all the records, the official case file, is missing. Still the same result. So the defense counsel, he or the defendant, tells defense counsel, I didn't do those things. These computerized records are wrong. Defense counsel goes to the courthouse, checks out the official file. They're missing, as they often are with old convictions, at least in some courts, state courts. Still enough?
Well, I do want to make sure that the court appreciates what seems to have been lost in the argument with appellant's counsel or of appellant's counsel. These are the official records of the District Court of Maryland. That is what the attestation attached to those records indicated. There's no dispute. These are official records of the court.
They're official records, but it's not the official case file or the formal judgment of conviction, correct?
It is not the official case file. That is correct, Your Honor. But where
there is an official case file, presumably.
Except your question was if it was lost.
Right, okay.
These electronic records reflect the official records of the Court of Conviction.
Who entered the data in these records?
If I can go outside the record, because obviously this was not established at the trial court level, I'm happy to speak to that. What I know from the District Court of Maryland is that the courtroom deputy enters those records contemporaneous with the disposition of the case. But that was obviously.
When did they do it?
Contemporaneously with the disposition of the case, such as the courtroom deputy sitting here, the courtroom deputy sitting in there and entering electronic records as it happens. But as I say, that's outside the record. In any event, Your Honors, if you have no further questions, I do respectfully.
I have one more. If the standard were beyond a reasonable doubt, would these computerized certified records be sufficient in the government's judgment?
As to the fact of conviction, there can be no dispute that there would not be much of a reasonable doubt if you had nothing but equivocation from the defendant who was convicted and you had official certified records from the district court that entered the conviction.
Just
the conviction
assume was. Silence. Don't put anything in from the defendant. Would these records by themselves meet a reasonable doubt standard?
Certainly, unless there was some reason to doubt them, which there isn't here. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. You had used all your time, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Chief Judge Santel. I would like to point out that these records are less reliable than the docket listing that this court rejected in Price. A docket listing at least says what the sentencing judge is. And
Price, did we reject the docket listing, or did we reject a PSR that merely referred to a docket listing? I thought it was the latter.
I think the docket listing was dicta. I don't think that it was, in fact, a docket listing in that case. I think that the court said that a docket listing would not be reliable had that been presented, but nothing was presented in Price. And I'd like to ask the court to just consider what is the PSR? Is the PSR evidence like the Ninth Circuit appears to believe? Because I don't think, or is it more like a magistrate's report and recommendation?
We have more than the PSR here, though.
We do, and that's
just the PSR. You'd have a stronger case.
And I do believe that the court did rule here, and so this court doesn't even need to reach the Price Pinnock because evidence was submitted. And the question was that reliable? Was the court's finding that evidence was reliable, clearly erroneous? We have not conceded that Price controls this case, and we do think this case can be distinguished based on the extent of the criminal history that the
Price didn't
age
consider Mitchell, right? I looked at the briefs in Price. Mitchell wasn't raised there.
No. The issue in Price came up didn't come up in the briefing in Price, unfortunately. Okay. I think it was missed, so okay. That question was not raised. I do think that Price can be distinguished based on the age of the criminal history and based on the defendant's likelihood of recalling the criminal history, to the extent that this court does decide Price. And we strongly believe that these records are not sufficient to reach a preponderance standing finding that the convictions, in fact, occurred. Thank you very much, Your Honor, unless the court has other questions.
Yes. Call the next case.